we're working off of the second revision, and there'll be one bill which will be taken off of that revision, and that's House Bill 3214. Received word from the sponsor that the issue will be taken up in a Senate bill. I was asked to inform the committee that the bus is going to, or the van going to Coos Bay will leave at 1 o'clock tomorrow. I think everyone has that time and date in mind that's going on the Coos Bay venture. Hope this is on the first one.
We can probably end with these two guys as well.
Yeah, okay.
How do you want to do it?
All right. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2914. Ask Representative Boquist to come forward.
Mr. Chair, you mean 2941?
I'm sorry, I meant 2941, yes.
Thank you.
I'll ask, go ahead, sit down, Representative, and I'll have counsel explain the bill.
Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2941 permits a man to petition the court to reopen the issue of paternity if a blood test shows that there's a 0% probability that the man is the father of the child. Allows a man to do this at any time. It also establishes conditions under which the court may render a judgment of non-paternity. I have heard from LFO that there's going to be a fiscal impact on this bill. I have not received a statement yet.
Representative, good morning. State your name for the record, and please testify for us.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Brian Boquist. I'm the representing the 23rd House District. This bill was actually, and I'm a co-sponsor on this bill, and let me explain my interest and then read several things into the record if you'll indulge me, Mr. Chair. For the record, in addition, I'm in my 30th year as a reserve component officer and have in fact been in numerous commands overseas, which again is the interest in my bill. You'll note that the summary permits a man to petition to reopen a paternity if a blood test shows 0% probability that he's the father. The issue that I'm going to raise and talk briefly about today, Mr. Chair, is the issue of soldiers who are deployed overseas. In the 30 years as a reserve component and active duty officer, numerous times I've been overseas and had to prepare affidavits to send back to various states here in the continental U.S., indicating that soldiers had been serving in excess of the time that a child was actually conceived and born. And in almost every single case across the United States, the soldier lost the paternity case but then had to have it reopened when they actually returned to the continental U.S. because under various laws, the federal statutes, those soldiers are not released to come back and testify. And in many cases, the blood tests, of course, performed overseas, they're either not facilities or not recognized. I would like to bring two cases to the view of the committee that are actually ongoing, and I'm not going to give the last names or anything because these are legal actions that are happening right now, but give you a feel for the issue that various soldiers, sailors, and airmen face in regards to paternity actions in their absence. And I'm going to quote from an email here. I talked to Chris. He came home 3 weeks ago to see his son, Michael. When he first got home, he saw Mike a couple times. His wife demanded money, and Chris couldn't come up with a full amount. She threatened to get Chris in trouble, so she filed a restraining order against Chris, stating they had threatened her and he was going to take Mike. Chris said this was not true. Her legal counsel started calling Chris's commanding officer in the military every day, which Chris said angered the CO. Now, having been a commanding officer, I know what it's like to have the attorneys calling you every day, especially overseas. Chris heads to Guam tomorrow for 6 months. And again, it's an issue where this happens to be a sailor who came back to the United States, was on leave, and then is redeploying overseas, and so is not in a legal position to defend himself. And what this bill, of course, would do is allow him, when he returned, to defend himself and reopen the case. The second email I'm going to read to you that I actually received from a soldier is, Steve is real discouraged with the whole mess. Steve hopes that you can view... You can help him with a baby that is not his. We cannot believe that Steve may have to pay child support. Everyone knows Steve was not here in the continental United States when the baby was conceived, and we think the father is actually living in the house. And then it goes on to talk about the legal expenses that he has incurred. And again, this is a sailor serving overseas who is not here when the baby was conceived. And of course, he's trying to defend himself as an absentee. And again, what my position on 2441, and I'd ask your indulgence and your due diligence on, is simply the issue of allowing soldiers, sailors, and airmen, as it pertains to this bill, that when they redeploy to the United States, that they have a legal option to actually defend themselves in person, and of course using new evidence, which would be a valid blood test taken here in the continental United States. With that, I would be happy to entertain questions pertaining to the bill as far as my perspective, and if not, Mr. Chair, I'll return to my duties elsewhere.
Fine, thank you. Do we have questions from the committee?
There was a reference to a fiscal on the bill, and is that for the blood testing? Is that the element? And I'll put that question maybe to counsel or to Representative Boquist.
It's from the Oregon.
I don't have an answer, Representative.
Okay. It's from the Oregon Judicial Department. I'm sure they'll talk about it as they come to testify later. It's my understanding it's for probably the number of cases that will be.
For the court process of the work.
Court process.
I see. Okay.
Thank you very much.
May I follow up to that question, Mr. Chair?
Yes, you may.
I would point out that if the fiscal is larger in the number of reprocessing of cases, it just simply indicates that we have a challenge, we have a problem in front of us. And what we, of course, like to do is be able to streamline this, save the state money, and in my perspective, help soldiers and sailors who come back do this in an economical basis, both for themselves and for the state.
Okay. Further questions from the committee? Hearing none, thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll call the next witnesses up, Steve Foley and Matt Minahan.
Good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. My name is Matt Minahan. I'm the lobbyist for Dad's America, and I'm here on behalf of Dad's America today. And actually, before I get started, if I could make a comment to the fiscal. The fiscal is related to the court process. I wanted to be very certain that this bill didn't cost the state any money, and the bill does require the petitioner, or the man ordered to pay child support in this case, to pay for any testing, attorney fees, and any costs related to the bill will be paid by the petitioner. House Bill 2941 that is before you today, I'd like to point out, is a near match to a bill that was passed in Georgia, the state of Georgia. This coming May will mark a 3-year anniversary for the Georgia legislation. I've also worked very hard with opposition to come to an agreement on amendments that you will be hearing later. In the state of Oregon, there are many ways paternity can be established, which can be found in ORS 109.070. I'll highlight a few ways in which paternity can be established. One, simply being married to the mother at time of conception establishes paternity. Even living with the mother at time of conception could establish paternity, and being named on the birth certificate or by signing an acknowledgement form. The acknowledgement form process is what Dad's America is affected by mostly. However, Dad's issues are not really with how paternity is established, but how paternity is established. Currently, the law only provides for challenges within a 1-year time frame. And let me kind of explain how the process works. If a mother is going in for child support or assistance, she goes into the state office or the county child support division and applies for child support. She is then asked to name a father, pick a father. And this is where the responsibility doesn't necessarily always lie in the mother. Sometimes the mother says, well, it's either Dad A, B, or C. What will happen is they'll be told, and we'll have some testimony hopefully later. If she can't make it, she'll send a letter. She used to work for the Child Support Division, and she'll be highlighting and detailing what I'm talking about. But basically, the mother is asked to name a father, and she'll say, well, it's either Dad A, B, or C. No, say pick one. Pick the most likely one. No blood tests, no... and in many cases, she doesn't know. So she'll name a father. And what will happen is the man will get a notice. It's an acknowledgement form served with a notice saying, we're the state, we're trying to establish paternity on you. Many, many of those cases, those notices go unanswered. And then the man is in default. And the one-year clock starts ticking. In some cases, the man does sign the form. Because the form doesn't necessarily say, oh, by the way, you may not be the father, there's two other candidates. In many of those cases, the man assumes he's the father because he was told the father. He was the father and he didn't know there were other candidates. So he signs the form and paternity is established. Another case where you're actually at the hospital. If the presumed father is there, whether they're if their child's born out of wedlock, but the father is there, and again he assumes he's the father, he'll be presented with the acknowledgement form. Once that form is signed, a one-year clock starts ticking, and once that 1 year is up, there's no challenge to paternity. Many cases, and I'd like to point out, in many of these cases, I mean, I know it's an issue of relationship with the child. Well, how is this going to affect the relationship with the child? And I'll explain later how child support is completely different from the relationship of the child. Dad's America is not anti-child support. We're not anti-visitation. We're not anti-child. We're pro-father's rights. But in many, many of these cases, the father is named, the father gets a notice, signs the form or doesn't sign the form, and a paternity is established, and he's paying child support regardless of the relationship of the child. In many of these cases, there isn't a relationship. Anyways, new evidence comes up later on. This comes in many forms. The main way it comes is the father is trying to assert rights on visiting the child, and the mother will simply say, I don't know why you're trying so hard to see these kids. They're not yours anyway. Another way is a friend or relative will show up and out of guilt and say, I have some information for you. Little Johnny isn't yours, and we've known that for some time. A third way is the child, as time progresses, simply doesn't share the same characteristics as the father. And friends and relatives and even the man has some questions. Another way, less common way, but it does happen, medical history. The father does have a relationship with the child or is called to donate organs or goes in an accident and the child's in an accident and wants to donate blood. And the doctor informs the presumed father, you cannot be the father of this child. Mom is B positive. You are B negative. This child is A negative. Now, I don't know if that works out. It's been a while since my biology 101 class, but you get the idea. If it's not possible for this child to be yours. Which brings up the medical history. If you know, we've lost, in that case, there has been significant medical history loss. If there's a hereditary heart condition, if there's some medical information that we need, the biological chain, that's gone. Because biological father, is not known or is not there. In these cases where new evidence is brought forward, the man ordered to pay child support generally runs and gets a DNA test. It gets some DNA testing, comes back to the courts and says, I have a DNA test that shows I am 0% probability I'm not the father. If it the 1 year time frame has lapsed, there is no avenue in which the father can take to reopen paternity. Even if, in many of the cases, especially in Georgia, which I'll highlight later, in many, many of the cases, they know who the father is once this new evidence comes up. The mother knows. And dad walks in, or the man walks in with a child with the DNA test and says, I'm not the father. And that guy is the father. Still nothing can be done. Now, in some cases, there can be some non-paternity orders, but it does require, and I'm going to be very specific on this, it requires everybody wanting the same result. Mom says, yeah, he's not the dad, he's the dad, and everybody agrees that in some cases there could be some non-paternity orders written. It's important to point out that this bill isn't anti-child support. Dad's agrees with child support. We just want the right man to be paying child support. It's also, especially with the amendments that you'll hear about coming, it's not only it's not a men versus women issue. There's several women that could be using this, and I'll give you one scenario that probably doesn't happen very often, but we do. Dad's America does have a case in Tennessee where this has happened. Mom has started a new relationship, and she's married. She's married, but she has started a new relationship, and she's dissolving the marriage. In that time, if the marriage doesn't quite finish and a child is born with the new relationship, that actual father, the first husband, actually has the paternity establishment, and along with paternity establishment, there comes rights to the child. Dad, in that case, most of the time, if everybody comes to the table and plays the same game, paternity can be, a non-paternity order can be issued. But quite frankly, if Dad wants to be a jerk, says, no, that's my child, and is mad at the mother for leaving him, he could, by statute, he's the father of that child, and he has rights to that child. He can order, he can have the courts order visitation, to send any art things the child makes in art class. And so this could also be used for women. The bill also is going to, there's going to be amendments that we've been working very hard on in agreement with that open it up to legal parents, not just fathers, ordered to pay child support. So in situations where legal parents, and it's the best interest of the courts to release paternity, could do that. Now, with regard to visitation, because part, you know, as I'm going around and selling this bill, I hear, well, the visitation and the child. And yes, Dad's America is not anti-child support, and we're not anti-child, we're not anti-visitation. It's very important to note that visitation is completely separate from child support. One, it takes Dad wanting to visit the child. Two, it takes Mom wanting to visit the child. And regardless of whether you're paying child support, it's up to Mom to let the child to let Dad be seen. We have cases, I'm on the website, and I get 3 or 4 cases daily where men call me asking for help. They're paying child support, they're no arrearages, they're trying to see the child, but for whatever reason they cannot see the child, and they in some of the cases actually have family plans in place. It's up to Mom to let them see the child. Their dad's paying child support or not. And again, in many cases, we know who the biological dad is. If we can transfer child support, visitation is still separate. If I go into the child support division and I say, I'm Matt Minahan, I'm caught up on my child support, I've been paying religiously, and she's not letting me see the child, the child support agency is going to say, I'm sorry, we can't help you. Because by law, child support is different from visitation. There is an ordinance in current statute now that allows, see if I can't remember the number on that, that allows, it's called an ongoing clause, I believe it's 109, it's the ongoing relationship clause that allows Dad to visit Dad. It's 109.119, rights of person who establishes emotional ties. So in other words, if I find out that I'm not the biological father, and we know who is, but I've been taking care of little Johnny, and little Johnny's calling me Dad, and I have a relationship, and I want to continue that relationship, I can use this bill, not pay child support, have the actual biological father take responsibility and pay support, use this ordinance that's already in place to continue that relationship, to file a motion and say, I want to visit that child. And I'll tell you, I've worked with dads for some time now, and visitation is, if everybody doesn't agree on visitation, Mom or Dad, it is extremely hard. And it's very easy for Mom to hold the child and not let Dad see the child. I have dads call me every day, I want to see my child, I want to see my child, and can't. So it kind of concerns me that sometimes that issue comes into this bill, whether we can... the visitation, you won't be able to see the child, the emotional ties, that can all happen regardless of whether that man is ordered to pay child support or not. There's also some concerns that the children are suddenly going to be fatherless. We're going to have thousands of children that are fatherless. Dad's America is not stating that the mother has fertilized her own egg and that there's no father. There is a father. There is a biological father out there. And I will highlight a letter that I'd like, that I believe you have a copy of, from Cornell Smith, who was the author of the bill in Georgia 3 years ago and has written you a letter stating about what has happened in Georgia. In almost every case, when the bill was used in Georgia, the mother was able to name the father. It turns out the child was not fatherless. They knew who the father was. In one case, it was a pastor of a church, and the mother didn't really want to admit that she had a secondary relationship. In all the other cases, they were married men. And quite frankly, in some cases, the mother did come in and say it's either dad A, B, or C. She didn't know. She was asked to pick the most likely candidate, and she did that. She did the right thing. Just that wasn't the case. So to answer that question of being fatherless, they won't be fatherless. I mean, we'll find the father, and the father's out there. And that brings me to kind of the responsibility that I feel that lies on the state as far as just picking a father. I mean, the mother could really literally walk in with a phone book and pick a name. She could take a phone book in and say, that's the dad, they'll send him a letter. The state has some federal requirements they have to meet, and that was part of our meeting with the amendments. You know, we wanted to make sure that they were in line with the federal requirements so they were able to receive federal funding. Part of those requirements are to establish a 90% rate of paternity or better on all children born out of wedlock. If they don't do that, they're going to lose federal funding. So in my mind, I hope I'm not correct, but in my mind, I think they're in the paternity establishment business. Okay, mom walks in, pick one.
Mr. Minahan, you mentioned some amendments. We don't have those, do we?
I don't think so. I think those are...
Could you perhaps summarize those for us so that we know where this bill may go? Are you ready for that question?
Sure. Basically, one of the amendments is it allows paternity not only to be challenged by a father ordered to pay child support, but by any legal parent. It also has some federal cleanup in there that one of the ways to get out of child support, one of the requirements being that he didn't sign the acknowledgement form and knowing, I'm not doing a very good job on that. They could probably, I think someone's going to speak today to the amendments, and they could probably do a much better job.
Okay,
and that brings me to a good point. This bill is really designed for the father who didn't know. We don't want dads stepping in, playing father, and then stepping out. This bill does not help the man who says, I know these kids aren't mine, but I'm going to sign this form, I'm going to play dad, and when we get divorced, I'm going to say see you later, and I'm not going to pay child support. It excludes adoption. It excludes artificial insemination. Father has to prove he did not know. He did not know when he was signing that form that these kids were his. So it excludes that. We really want to just cover the guy who found out later. And there's a time frame involved. And that might be because of the cost. Quite frankly, I don't care what the bill costs if it does the right thing and it's a just bill. My issue on the time frame is if dad finds out 5 years later, say he really didn't know and he gets a call 5 years later, guess what, these kids aren't yours, or someone knocks on the door. I don't care if it was 2 years or 5 years or 10 years. I don't care when dad finds out. If he was actually lied to and he was then paying child support and there's no relationship and he's paid $30,000 in child support, this bill doesn't say dad gets it or the man gets that money back. This bill says from that point on, you don't have to pay. Doesn't allow for getting that money back. I guess this is the point where I say not only am I the lobbyist for Dad's America, but I am a paternity fraud victim. That's how this bill came about. I was in a relationship for about 6 years. She left and within a month got married and married the real biological father of three children. I got a phone call and said, guess what? You're not the father of these children. You'll never see these kids, but you are going to pay child support. She lied to me. It was 6 years. I don't care if she lied to me 6 years ago, 2 years ago, or 10 years ago. She lied to me and I didn't know. And you know what? She was right. I had to pay child support. Point out that I have since fixed this because mom came to the table. I finally went and got my parental rights. And it's right before I was getting my parental rights, she was moving to South Carolina and she made an agreement with me. Mom didn't come to the table. I certainly would have had to pay $680 a month child support while she was living with the biological dad. It cost me $8,000, but I finally got to meet the state child support division head lady. And I told, I had DNA tests, and I said, I am not the father. Gary Rigdon is the father up in Wenatchee, Washington, where she lives. The answer was, it doesn't matter. Paternity has been established. The one-year time frame is up, and I don't care. Well, I did care, so I went to Western Oregon University, got a political science degree, and got hold of Cornell Smith, drafted up what I think is a fair, honest bill, and that's what brought us here today. If we have any questions, I'd be more than happy to.
Thank you. Questions from the committee, Representative Gerard?
Mr. Minahan, the Department of Justice, and this may be covered by one of your amendments, but I just wanted to, in regard to the voluntary acknowledgement process, that your bill takes out that one-year window in which the alleged father has to retract a voluntary acknowledgement. And they want something put back in to comply with the federal regulation. Is that what one of the amendments will do?
I think that has been done. Yes. Yes.
You're okay with that?
I'm okay with that.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Representative McPherson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Minahan, you were citing 109.119 of ORS as a basis for under which a father could, as a non-father, I guess, somebody who was a later established non-paternity, would still have the opportunity to have visitation rights ordered. And I guess question I would like to raise is, does that seem appropriate to you that an individual would be seeking to establish non-paternity and on the one hand, and at the same time invoking a provision that looks like it's mainly aimed at the grandparents and step-parents visitation to still seek an ongoing relationship with the child? Isn't that trying to have it both ways?
A lot of people do see it as having your cake and eating it too. But in reality, if visitation is held up, that father won't see the child, regardless of paying child support. But why can't, if we know who the father is, I was lied to, we know who the father is, why can't that father pay child support? And if we are interested in the best interest of the child, and that child has an emotional tie with me, why can't I still continue to see the child? First of all, dad's got to want to, and my heart, I hope he does. Two, mom's got to let him. And three, what is it? I mean, why can't that dad, if we know who the biological father is, why can't he take responsibility for the child support and I continue the relationship? Because it comes back, it doesn't, we have rights for the child here, but we also have to look at, we have father's rights too. We have father's rights who are ordered to pay child support, garnished money. It's almost like slavery. You will work for this child. I see it. We can have the cake and eat it too. I would love to see, I didn't see my children. I would have loved to. I would have paid child support, continued in a minute had I could see those children. I couldn't see the children. But yeah, I would say, and I do tell dads to use, you know, this is one avenue. If dad was feeding the child, clothing the child, providing a roof over the head, and knows who dad is, why can't that dad pay the child support and the relationship continue? I mean, if we're concerned about the child and that's important to the child, let the relationship continue. Well, I don't see what it has to do with child support.
Other questions? Representative Krieger.
Yeah. Chair Ackerman. Matt, have you looked at the amendments close to see that the ones that you got, I think there's only one set of amendments, isn't there?
There's a couple floating around. One that I have approved. There are some amendments that I'll be discussing with the Department of Justice that I disagree with. They have the 2 years. I disagree with those set. I do agree. We've had several meetings with the amendments coming from the group back here. We do have one set.
I just wanted to make sure we understood there were two sets of amendments and that there was one group, you know, working. And I've asked Bill Taylor to work with Matt and some people yet to kind of refine those a little bit, make sure that we're clear where we are on those.
I think what we'll do, we'll cover that when the other witnesses come up, just to outline what you think the amendments are. I don't think we'll need a lot of testimony on the bill itself. We're going to concentrate on the amendments.
I have a set of those amendments that I could answer if you'd like.
Well, let's go through the questions first, and then see how we want to handle the amendments, okay? And I had a question. You and I had talked about this, and my concern is on the first page of the bill, where the petition is filed and has to allege that as a result of blood tests administered within 90 days before the petition was filed, that there's a 0% probability that the petitioner is the father of the child. Now, I can understand how the father can go get a blood test, but I don't understand how you can compel, or you don't compel, the mother of the child to get the blood test. So it seems to me that every petition that's going to be filed is only going to have the blood test of the dad, not the mother, not the child. It's going to be inherently defective.
Chair Ackerman, that's a good question. You don't need the mother for a DNA test. Nowadays...
I'm saying blood. You have blood here.
Blood tests as defined, which includes accredited DNA testing. And nowadays, you can order a kit online and swab your cheek, swab the child's cheek, and know within 45 minutes. And that's why... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, is the bill going to be changed then from blood tests to DNA?
It serves the same purpose. Oregon defines blood tests as DNA testing, and it fits within that. Blood testing is kind of the umbrella for DNA. And
I think you may be correct, with that interpretation, but I'm applying an interpretation that a lawyer or a judge might look at and say, well, wait a minute, you're coming here with DNA. Statute only authorizes blood tests. We're reading the statute literally as you drafted it. I just think that there's a problem here that you have to work out in defining a blood test to include DNA. That's okay, but I think it's got to be in the bill and you should consider that.
And in line three there it says...
Tell me where you are.
I'm actually in the draft. The three, upon receipt of petition, the court may or may motion a party shall order the mother, child, and petitioner to submit the blood test as provided in ORS 109.250.
Okay.
And in 109.250, blood test is defined, DNA is listed in the...
Okay. Well, I was just asking a technical question, how you can... what the viability of the blood test is on the initial petition, when that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
The blood test just as the father, you can establish 0% probability, which the petition requires. So I just wanted to rethink that one when we go back to the amendment process.
I'll certainly take a look at that issue. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions of Mr. Minahan?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Perhaps not so much a question, but I would like to read into the record 109.251, which does define blood tests. As used in ORS 109.250 to 109.262, blood tests includes any test for genetic markers to determine paternity of a type generally acknowledged as reliable by accreditation bodies designated by the Department of Human Services in compliance with the United States Secretary of Health and Human Services and performed by a laboratory approved by such accreditation body. Blood tests includes, but is not limited to, human leukocyte antigen test, DNA test, and any test that extracts genetic material from any human tissue. So by reference, the definition would include DNA testing.
Okay, thank you, Representative. That's a good point.
Yeah. And another point I'd like to say, that test that the man does isn't necessarily the last test that will get done. In the process, another DNA test is ordered, because you can literally get these online and have a DNA test, and who knows if you're... who's been swabbed. Maybe it was the dog that was swabbed. Who knows? And then, so the judge does have a avenue to go down that will reorder another accredited DNA test.
Okay, thank you. I want to get on with the hearing because our session begins, I think, at 10:45 today. Am I correct? So I want to be out of here by 10:30. We have one more substantial bill to get to, but we will get to your witnesses. But I just want to let you know ahead of time that we will conclude the public hearing today and have to send you back for the amendments and then come back one more time. Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Foley?
Yes. I traveled from Portland today to testify on behalf of Dads in America, but I am also, too, a duped father. I did not really know what that meant when I heard that term, but I learned that it meant that I was basically a tool of somebody. I was deceived by my wife. I was married for 20 years, and in this marriage there were two girls born. Now one is now 20 and the other is 16 years old. Both are born in the marriage. After my ex-wife left me in September 2003, I found out in September of 2004 from one of her ex-best friends that the girl of 16 was not mine but a product of an affair that she was having for the last 20 years with another married man. Now, how she found out was they were on the way back from a trip from Canada, and she basically just blurted it out that, you know, my youngest daughter is she's not the biological father, but a product of an affair I've been having with this other married man. She mentioned this man's name, but she even brought out two pictures of one of my daughter, the other one of her daughter, and they said, see how much they look alike, they're almost identical twins. And of course the lady brought up the fact of, well, what happens if Steve finds out? Well, you'll never find out. And then they also made that she made the statement to her, what about medical responsibilities? What about DNA? I mean, if she was to have a medical problem in a hospital, what would become of that? And she basically said, well, I'll just address that if that ever comes up, but he doesn't have to know. This man is married. He's 15 years older than my ex-wife. He has children of his own and lives in a home up in the West Hills. I went back to court and got the right to do a DNA test. It was so very easy, I found out. I ordered it online, and all the products for the test were already here in town, and the total cost was only $470. I went to the Wade Center in Portland, just above the food court. That is where the collection facility was. With just a couple of cotton swabs, one to the left cheek and one to the right cheek, I was out of there in 20 minutes. About 19 minutes of that actually was spent IDing me and the parties. You know, they take a picture, they have you sign it. There was some real strict IDing that was going on that for myself and to make sure that was the... And then they took the cotton swab on my left and right cheek and then dismissed me. One week later, I had the test results in my hand. And I found out I was 0% match. I didn't know what a 0% match meant. I had to call the company I ordered the DNA test from, and he said, Steve, a 0% match means that you are not the biological father. You couldn't be farther from the biological father at all. So at that time, when I found out, of course, even though I actually knew that there's a potential of me not being the father of this child, when I actually saw it in writing and actually the proof, I just hung the phone up and I went and took a two-hour walk, and I had to walk that off. It was quite an emotional blow to me. The people that knew that the 16-year-old girl was not mine for all these last 16 years were my ex-wife, her sister, whom she told, and yes, the biological father knew as well. I never knew nor suspected all these years that he had the benefit of watching his biological daughter grow up with no cost to him. This man was reported to me that he even attended some of my 16-year-old daughter's functions throughout the years when I could not attend. We raised llamas in the 4-H department at the county fairs. He would show up when I wasn't there and watch her perform with the llamas. I had no idea that this was going on, but I was told this through her ex-best friend. I did not really know what to call this when it happened to me, so because I was all brand new to this, and I got on the internet and started doing some keyword searches, and eventually came up with a phrase called paternity fraud. And the definition of paternity fraud is very clear when it reads a mother lies about who the biological father of the child really is. It can occur between non-married or individuals within a marriage. So I went and visited a paternity attorney in Portland because I absolutely knew nothing about what was going to be the potential outcome of this. If this is fraud, then there should be some kind of restitution. Since since the child is his. I envision that I could seek some kind of restitution for pain and suffering. Imagine my surprise that I found in the state of Oregon that ordained to get disestablished from the child, so I didn't have to pay child support. Imagine my surprise that I found in the state of Oregon that some of the laws we have on establishing paternity, but I could not do very little as the laws read now. The attorney told me in Portland that some of these laws are written way before DNA testing and only marriage established paternity. Before DNA testing, one would have to have had the wisdom of King Solomon, he told me, to establish paternity. Now we have a test that's 99.9% accurate and is readily available. It was my disbelief that the laws were not in my favor and I could not make somebody held accountable for what they have done due to the fact of this one-year cap. I never knew. Meanwhile, the deadbeat dad is left to go about their lives without responsibility and in total ignorance of the havoc he helped create in my life. Unfortunately, most men discover the lie after the relationship has ended. I had no idea how to react. Complicated by the intense emotions described to me as a feeling of worse than death, denial, pain, and mourning, and anger phases often paralyze them and myself with indecisions while having to make timely legal moves. The man who did not create this child most often bears both emotional scars and the financial consequences. Where is this good biological father in all of this? Society has long acknowledged the connection between biological parents and their children. And your wife can have an affair, become pregnant, and tell you it's your child, full well knowing it is not yours and may not be. She may even divorce you and have you pay child support. If you require DNA evidence that you are not the child and the victim of a deceit, not only is she not charged with an offense, the courts insist that she is right. The child is yours forever and you pay the support, not the real father who could be found. Current laws are written before DNA testing and the divorce rate was 3%. No one can be certain of paternity in any case as the assumption has to be made. If a woman lied or was uncertain, there was no way to tell for sure. Men were held to account for anything that their wives did. There should be no cap on this paternity bill. I did not find out for 16 years that the ex-wife kept mommy's little secret for that long. The news was heartbreaking enough, but when I found it, I had no avenue to make a wrong righted. That I just should accept this lie and be good with it. It does change your heart. This is the way I view all of this. Many men are deceived by women, and we are in no mood to accept. The legal system does not recognize DNA science in such cases. It's like they are saying, let your wife cheat on you, have children by other men, divorce you, and you have to pay for it all. I would advocate that if a mother knowingly puts down the wrong father, it should be considered wrong. It is time we wake up at the real problem that it is fraud. Lying deadbeat moms and deadbeat dads should be held responsible. I would like finally to be able to go back and make the biological father held accountable for his wrong. It changes your heart when you see a child walk through the door that is not yours. The mother just can stay back and just say, I tricked him fair and square. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Foley. Are there questions from the committee of this witness?
I have a question.
Yes, Representative Worth.
And it sounds, Mr. Foley, that you were, for all intents and purposes, the day-to-day father of this 16-year-old non-biological daughter of yours. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So she's the following.
Yeah.
So, and I don't think that you want to give the impression that gift that that she considered you her father and you consider her your daughter was not worth the cost of raising her.
Well, when you walk a mile in someone's shoes, then you start to understand. It does change your heart. It really does change your heart. This is to me a product of an affair, and it did change my heart. I do not see the daughter at this time, but I hope someday to reestablish a relationship with her.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, then, gentlemen, you're excused, and I'll take the next panel. Thank you very much. I'll take the remaining witnesses, so Ronell Schenkel, Sybil Hebb, Lisa Sidlick, and got one more. I hit the name right. Yeah. Shani Fuller. Let me ask just overall, are you folks going to relate to the amendments, the bill, or both?
Chair Ackerman, both. I was planning with your agreement to give you a very broad overview. Shaney and Sybil have been working closely with Mr. Minahan and can talk about the amendments, and then Melissa has the additional amendments.
You think that we can get through the panel in 20 minutes? Is that asking too much of you?
Absolutely.
I mean, I have some flexibility here, but I've got another two more bills to go. Okay, whomever would like to go first, I don't know. What order you want?
I will begin for the record. Chair Ackerman and members of the committee, Ron L. Shankle, here today on behalf of Attorney General Hardy Myers and the Department of Justice. You have my written testimony before you, so I won't go through all of it. I will just attempt to highlight some issues. First of all, let me acknowledge this is a very tough issue that you have before you today. And this has come up in several past legislative sessions, and other committees before you have not been willing or able to take it on. So I commend both you and Mr. Minahan for doing so. Having said that, let me tell you briefly, the Department of Justice is involved in various aspects of family law. We have attorneys in our Civil Enforcement Division Family Law Section who work in the juvenile courts, and issues of paternity are often at stake there, and children involved in abusive situations. We also have responsibility for the Oregon Child Support Program, and they serve approximately 250,000 families in Oregon currently, dealing with both the establishment of paternity but also the reopening of paternity and sometimes the disestablishment and ultimately orders of non-paternity. They provide all of those services as much as existing law allows. Finally, we have been involved with Department of Justice in reviewing what is a National Uniform Parentage Act. That is not a federal mandate for the states, but it is out there as a model, and provided a summary to the Oregon Law Commission. The Law Commission has approved a work group to get together. They have not yet begun their work, but they will be looking very broadly at the issue before you today, as well as other issues related to paternity. So that is coming forward. The bill as originally drafted, the Attorney General has no position on the policy issue. We would have to oppose the provision that Matt and then Representative Garrard referenced that goes a little bit too far in taking out some of the language about voluntary acknowledgments. However, the amendments will put that back in and bring us into compliance. That is related to a state plan requirement for us to have particular information about voluntary acknowledgments in our law. However, there is some flexibility to change the process around the law, and that's what this bill will do. With the consensus amendments, which is what we've been referring to, Mr. Minahan said that he had been working, and it is true, for a great deal of time, and effectively with Shaney Fuller from our Division of Child Support and Sybil Head from the Oregon Law Center, and we do have consensus amendments that will come before you. They're actually attached to Ms. Fuller's testimony, or what we sent down to Legislative Council. Those amendments make the bill workable and would move us into a position of neutral because it takes away any compliance issues for the Department of Justice. You will actually end up seeing, I believe, two sets of amendments. One is the compromise language that cleans up the legal issues, and as Mr. Minahan said, also adds the ability for any parent, mom, or dad to open the issue. But you'll have a second set, the exact same thing, with the addition of a sunset clause for your consideration. And so that will also be forthcoming, but they are being drafted separately. With the sunset clause, I just want to say briefly that, as several of you are aware or have become aware, the paternity laws in Oregon are based on common law practices that have been around for a great deal of time and legal procedures. But what you're also hearing is true. These laws were put into place before there was DNA. And some of these processes and some of these family dynamics simply were not considered at the time that these laws were enacted. We do impact, by changing the paternity laws, thousands of families, the men, the women, and the children, and you're well aware of that. One of the benefits of establishing paternity, and Mr. Minahan referred to some of this, is that it gives the father legal standing. That's what ties that father to the ability to enter into the custody discussions and the parenting time discussions. It also gives the children some legal rights by having that father. It also does involve child support, that is true, but this bill is not just about child support, or as drafted, it doesn't just do away with the child support. It does also do away with some of those rights for the father and the child. There was reference to another statute that may allow that father to still have a connection. That is one of the unintended consequences we don't know about. We've never been in a scenario where the court would have the ability to say, okay, you are not the legal father because we have DNA testings, But will they still give those fathers visitation time, or will they still give them custody? We don't know. And so that's one of the pieces we are somewhat worried about and why we're seeking a sunset clause. We're not seeking a sunset clause because we want this to go away in 2 years. We're seeking a sunset clause because we want you to call some group of us back and say, how is this working? So those were the highlights I was going to hit. The rest of it is in my testimony, and I'll turn it over to the others to talk about the amendments.
Fine, thank you. We know this is going to go back for reworking on the amendments, so it might be totally premature to exhaust all the amendments before they come back again, because you're going to get another public hearing. But just in the interest of time, so you don't duplicate, give us any new materials that you can on your position or on the amendments.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Ackerman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shaney Fuller. I am with the Oregon Child Support Program with the Department of Justice. Ms. Schenkel touched on the position of the Department of Justice, and so I won't reiterate that. In my written testimony, I have provided you with information on the methods for establishing paternity in Oregon currently and the methods for challenging that. There is also a table in my testimony that adds what the changes of 2941 would be with and without the amendments. So when you have time, you might take a look at that. Moving to the amendments, as stated that you've heard here today, we have worked with Matt Minahan and Sybil Hebb in coming up with some compromise amendments, and those are with LC at the current time. The draft is attached to my testimony, and I will just walk you through the highlights if I could at this point. In Section 2, Paragraph 1, it adds any legal parent. That is a compromise with the Oregon Law Center, and that they wanted the mother to be able to have the ability to challenge paternity as well. And so that has been added to the amendments. Moving down, there was quite a bit of discussion surrounding blood tests, and in paragraph 3 of section 2, there is some clarification regarding blood tests, as Representative Flores read into the record. That is a defined term, and legislative counsel is the one who has changed that to be consistent throughout in the original draft. But this would clarify that if the blood tests were conducted early on and was a, what we call a motherless draw, just a blood test between or genetic test between the father and the child, that the court can order further testing at that time, or if, say, it was a genetic testing by mail and the court is not confident that all processes were complied with, the court could order further testing once that matter is being heard in court. Moving further down in section, paragraph 6E of section 2, really we added one statement that combines a laundry list of things that the father could not have done with knowledge that he was the father. And what we have said that if either parent took action to affirm parentage knowing that the actual father was not the father, that they cannot make use of Section 6 here that would require the court to order non-paternity. Paragraph 7 is a piece that we have added in that is in the Georgia law currently. Georgia has a two-tier system that first the party must show, if they show all of these things in paragraph 6, then the court shall make a determination of non-paternity. Georgia says that even if the parent can't show these things, that the court may exercise their discretion and still enter a determination of non-paternity, and we have added that into the draft as well because we did not believe that if all the parties are in court, that the sole determination should turn on whether the party had knowledge or not, and that it should turn on the best interests of the child. You'll see also in 7B there is a reference to the voluntary acknowledgement of paternity. That is federal language that we have talked about previously that we need in order to comply with federal law. Paragraph 8 talks about child support. That is consistent with our other provisions regarding child support. in that the order would continue up until the date of a determination of non-paternity. A court could choose to wipe out any arrears that the obligor owes, but the obligor parent would not be able to get a credit for any amounts paid previously. Paragraph 8C talks about a tort action against the biological mother or father, and it would preclude that under this section. Paragraph 10 talks about probate. We did not want the estate of a man to be able to come in and disinherit that child, and so that is an addition as well. Section 3 of the amendments has to do solely with the voluntary acknowledgement of paternity, at least the amendments, that is, and adds back those pieces that were taken out. We want to preserve our child support processes that we currently have. Section 2 does not replace the need for those, and as stated, we've added back in the federal pieces that we need as well. That is all I have. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Fine. I think I'll wait and take questions at the end. All right. Next witness, please.
Chair Ackerman and members of the committee, my name is Sybil Hebb. I'm with the Oregon Law Center. The Law Center is a statewide provider of civil legal assistance to low-income folks in Oregon. We have an interest in this issue because of the importance of the issue just itself, but also because of the heightened impact that these sorts of issues have on low-income Oregonians who are unable to easily afford counsel to help them deal with the issues that come up. Wanted to voice the support of the Law Center for the fact that, as others have, the Dads Association has identified a very real and compelling issue that the state has a responsibility to address in a comprehensive fashion. And so we appreciate the raising of that issue and recognize that it's unfortunate that it hasn't been raised or addressed before now. We do believe that with the advent of accurate and easily available DNA testing, there's no reason that we should not have systems in place which address the truth of biology in a balance of considerations that take into account the interests of the biological father, the biological parents, the legal father, and the children. And we want to stress that any solution that is put forward provides an appropriate balance of consideration of all of those interests. I also want to make it clear that in our experience with cases that we have seen, and I think the reality of the situation is that these cases come up where the mistaken identification of a legal father as someone who is not the actual biological father, those issues come up in a number of different circumstances. There may be a mistaken legal father identified through fraud, for sure, but there also may be a mistaken legal father identified merely because of the conclusive presumptions that apply right now under Oregon law, or because of pure mistake of fact, or perhaps because of an ill-considered decision to assume legal fatherhood or assert that, even knowing that that's not the truth of the biology. So there are a number of different ways in which we end up with a non-biological father who is identified as a legal father, and there ought to be some way to allow the state to take a look at those issues when raised. I want to also just caution us against taking any sweeping steps that are not very well considered and that don't take into account all of the other statutes that are involved and all of the interests that are at stake. And I want to be we think we need to be careful as a state not to, in addressing this admittedly and clearly very great injustice that's currently happening sometimes, want to make sure that we are not causing other great injustices when we take the step to address this. So we are supportive and have worked very closely with the Department of Justice and with Mr. Minahan in coming up with some consensus amendments that take a narrow interim step towards providing some resources or some redress here. The Law Center is supportive of that step being only an interim step and really urges the committee to voice support for the creation of an interim work group. As Ms. Schenkel and Ms. Fuller, I think, referred to, the Oregon Law Commission has decided to convene a work commission. The Law Center would be happy to serve as a member of that commission should that be deemed appropriate, and voice the support that all of the interested parties and stakeholders be included in that procedure. I just wanted to briefly address the Dash 1 amendment substantively, and while, again, we're supportive of them being an interim step, we also believe that they leave some important issues unaddressed that will need to be looked at by the interim committee. For example, this bill requires that the petitioner, come forward with the results of a blood test. In some circumstances, it may be very difficult or, in fact, impossible for the petitioner to have to achieve a blood test that can prove 0% chance that the legal father is the biological father. And maybe there should be some way for us, for the courts, to provide the ability for a petitioner to obtain those blood tests if they're not able to do that on their own. We want to make very sure that children aren't at the sort of center of a struggle in obtaining a blood test there. So there should be some process that allows for that to happen systematically and fairly. Another concern that the Law Center has had and has identified for the group is that children have an interest in these issues as well as legal parents, and there may be circumstances in which a child may have an interest in identifying the true biological father, and this current consensus amendment would not give the child status as a party to file a petition, and we think that's something that should be considered strongly by an interim work group. So there's just a couple of the concerns that we have, and again, we're supportive of the consensus amendments, but just want to make sure that we don't lose balance sight of the interest of the child in addressing this concern. Again, happy to serve on a work group if the committee chooses to take that direction, and really appreciate your time in looking at this complicated issue. Thanks.
Fine, thank you. Last witness, please.
Yes, good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the subcommittee. I am Belissa Seidlick. I am family law senior policy analyst with the Oregon Judicial Department, and I am here to talk to you today about some of the concerns that the department has, as well as the workload on the courts that the bill would have if passed. And this workload would exist even with the consensus amendments.
Can I interrupt a moment?
Sure.
I read your memorandum, and I think it's 2.5 pages, and I was just want to compliment you on the memorandum. It was very well done. You get all the information in less than 3 pages, which is wonderful. You analyze the policy concerns, the fiscal concerns, and the implications of the bill. So I just want to compliment you on that. It was extremely well done. I enjoyed reading it.
Oh, thank you very much, Chair Ackerman. I appreciate that. I will just touch briefly on what I have in the testimony. I would like to point out, in response to the testimony that's been given so far, this bill does have more far-reaching effect than applying to dads who have been defrauded. It applies to fathers who have established relationships with children. It applies to fathers who have paternity established not just by voluntary acknowledgement, but through a legal proceeding where a final judgment has been entered. It also pertains to dads who don't know, but the reason they don't know is not due to fraud or misrepresentation. So it does not have the limited effect that I believe Mr. Minahan thought it would. I wanted to point out that there have been a number of states who have had to deal with this issue since the advent of DNA testing. And in my research, I have found that most states have a specific time period in which a man can petition to disestablish paternity. The time period is also recommended by the Uniform Parentage Act. And this time period is a period of 2 years after either the filing of the voluntary acknowledgement, 2 years after the child's birth, or 2 years after the adjudication in a legal proceeding. Other states that have adopted a 2-year limitation are California, Oklahoma, Texas, Washington, and Illinois. A 1-year limitation has been imposed in North Dakota, Kansas, and Massachusetts, 3 years in Connecticut, 4 years in Texas, 5 years in Arkansas and Tennessee. So there are reasons for that, and some of the reasons that have been put forth, not just in these state statutes and in the Uniform Parentage Act, but in policy discussions, are that the greater the period of time that passes where a man believes that he's the father and others are relying upon that belief, the harder it is to establish and identify who the real biological father is. Also, there's the greater possibility that there's a relationship, a close relationship that develops between the man and the child. And there's the greater likelihood that the child has become dependent not just on the financial support of that man, but upon the emotional support of his parentage. These other state courts and legislatures have also determined that equitable doctrines need to apply in considerations of disestablishment of paternity. In particular, there are res judicata applications where a judgment has been entered that is final and entitled to conclusive effect. It cannot be disturbed except on appeal, and where that time for appeal has passed, it cannot be relitigated. In fact, in Ohio, a statute similar to what House Bill 2941 would propose was found to be unconstitutional as a violation of the doctrine of separation of powers, in that it permitted conclusive final judgments of the court as to paternity to be overruled by a statute passed by the legislature. And they found that to be an unconstitutional action. Other equitable principles that have been applied by other states in similar situations include looking at the conduct of the parties. Did the man have an opportunity and know about the possibility for genetic testing? And in most cases of signing a voluntary acknowledgement of paternity, they are informed of that. Was there further lack of due diligence? Were there reasons to suspect, even if he didn't know that he was not the father, were there reasons to suspect and did he not act on them? And lastly, would a determination at this point in the family's relationship with each other cause harm to the child? That is another equitable concern that other states have allowed. And this bill, if passed as is, and even with the amendments, would not permit the courts to address. The word shall is in there. The courts would have to enter an order of disestablishment. Regarding the fiscal, the fiscal comes from an estimate on the number of cases that we would anticipate being filed if this bill passes. Currently, there are in the child support program over 68,000 cases in which paternity has been established and child support is being paid. In its more detailed fiscal, and I won't go into that because of time concerns, but there were four different percentages that were applied, eventually getting to the point of coming to 1,362 cases that we would estimate being filed in the first year, and for a biennium, 2,724 such petitions. And that is approximately 2% of this 68,000 number that it's the potential pool out there. This results in an over $600,000 workload increase to the courts. I also would represent on behalf of the department that in light of all of the policy concerns that are implicated by this bill and the amendments, having an interim work group take a considered look at all of the options and possibilities would be highly recommended, and we would be willing to participate in such a work group. Thank you. I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Fine. Thank you all for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Gerard?
I think this question would be directed more toward Ms. Hibb. But doesn't the two-year period in the amendments remove some of the long-range problems you would see with children?
Chair Ackerman and Representative Gerard, I may turn that over to Ms. Seidlich because I believe those are her amendments that would impose that limitation. But so thanks.
And I'm sorry, Representative Gerard, you said it would do what to the
Wouldn't the two-year, the imposition of the two-year window of opportunity, wouldn't that address many of the long-range issues that you have with the effect on the children involved?
Right. Within a shorter period of time, you won't have the likelihood of a long relationship that's been established already between the man and the child. There will be a better consideration of the equities and the interests of the child. I agree with you there. Yes.
Thank
so,
you.
Yes.
Other questions from the committee? Hearing none, then we'll excuse the panel. You do have the work group already formed. We don't need any assistance from the committee on that one. And we'll bring back those amendments then. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other person wishing to testify on this bill? If not, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2941. The next one on the agenda is House Bill 3266. At the request of Mr. Martinez, we'll do that last, or do you want to do it now? You can do it quickly because we have a major bill coming right behind you, Mr. Martinez. So with that in mind, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3266. Counsel, you want to summarize the bill, please?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 3266 modifies the definition of financial institution in relation to a seller's property disclosure statement. The purpose for this is that seller's property disclosure statements are required when somebody sells property. It gives detailed information about the residential property, such as the condition of the roof, things of that nature. Certain institutions are exempted from giving a seller's property disclosure statement, such as banks, because they may be foreclosing on it, may not have that kind of knowledge of the property. This bill adds trust companies to the definition of financial institutions and would therefore exempt them from giving a seller's property disclosure statement.
I'd also like to call Ken Sherman up, too, and see here.
Mr. Chairman, he is plugging his meter, but I will try to carry on without him. If he
All right.
Shows up, I'll have him join
you. You may proceed. Thank you.
But hopefully we'll be done before he gets back. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association, counsel summarizes the bill quite accurately and succinctly. When we rewrote the Bank Act a few years ago, we rewrote the definition of financial institution in a way that didn't include trust companies for every activity that a bank could do. And what we've done since then, and we did that on purpose because we wanted to make sure that there were certain things that probably didn't necessarily apply to trust companies as they did to banks. And this is probably the third or fourth session where we've added things back over time, and that's what we're doing here. We're adding back trust companies. I've had the conversations with the representatives of the realtors. They have no problem with this bill and would encourage your support, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? I guess there are none. You're getting off easy again today.
Always good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think we're ready to work it out into a work session. I'll hold the hearing open for a minute for Mr. Sherman, but if...
Mr. Chair, that's not necessary. I appreciate that.
You know,
I know your schedule is tight, so, you know, please.
Okay, so we'll proceed in that manner. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3266 and open a work session on House Bill 3266. Do I have a motion? Representative Gerard?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3266 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
President Garrard moves that House Bill 3266 be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on behalf of the committee? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 3266 is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation with Representative Garrard as carrier. And with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 3266 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3303 and ask the proponents to come forward, Trina Laidlaw, Anthony Vieta, and Mary Shortall.
Good morning. I'm Mary Shortall, and I represent the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. I'm here to testify on 3303, the -1 amendments, and there'll be upcoming amendments as well. We have 19 area agencies on aging throughout the state that provide Older Americans Act services under contract with the Department of Human Services. 8 of the 19 area agencies on aging also provide Medicaid services for elderly and disabled. The local state partnership benefits clients and provides a single entry and easy access for needed services as their conditions become more severe. This program, as you probably know, has worked very well, and it has been enabled through the legislation in Chapter 410 that was created back in 1981 or so. It's a partnership now that's being emulated around the country because Oregon has been so effective in keeping people in the best situation for them and keeping them out of nursing homes. And the spirit of Chapter 410 has been built around the cooperation between local and state government. Over the last 3 or 4 years, the partnership has been threatened due to the unbalanced provisions that are obtained in the contracts that we local governments are expected to sign with the state. House Bill 3303, with its amendments, is needed to bring this relationship back into balance and to restore the cooperation that's needed between the state and local government. House Bill 3303, with its amendments, also is needed to protect the vital services of our most vulnerable citizens, such as youth, people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, physical disabilities, and the elderly. The bill will provide a reciprocal termination and procedural remedies for collecting funds and for indemnification. It establishes that when contract language is unclear, it should be construed against the party that drafted it, and it protects against short, unreasonable deadlines for reviewing or obtaining, objecting to contracts in order to ensure continued funding for services at the local level. These changes have nothing to do with the local government's objections to performance measurements or our discomfort with risk sharing, as some opponents might say. As a matter of fact, with the changes in contracts, we now have 85 pages of performance measures, which are very clear and which we actually embrace. The changes are about recognizing the reciprocal nature of the relationship that exists between state and local government, and that's needed to provide effective and efficient services at the local level. During this time of shrinking resources at all levels of government, cooperation is needed more than ever, and these amendments will restore the balance in that contracting relationship. Thank you.
Thank you. You may testify in any order you wish.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Trina Laidlaw, and I'm an assistant county counsel for Lane County. Before I begin, I'd like to just note that we have submitted two letters for your written record, one from the Lane County Board of County Commissioners, signed by our chair, and one from me on behalf of 12 county councils representing 11 counties across the state, both large and small, as well as on behalf of six counties which have taken official action to support House Bill 3303 and its amendments. Just by way of background, the bill does cover some key contract provisions and common understandings that we feel we need for contracts between counties and state agencies generally. Approximately 3.5 years ago, we began discussions with one state agency, and that was DHS. Several county councils and other representatives from counties met with representatives from DHS on a task force to discuss contract terms. And this was about 3.5 years ago, as I mentioned. There were some specific contract provisions that counties identified that they were most concerned about. They were related to termination, making sure their level of performance for services was commensurate with the funding that was available, indemnity, and making sure that the collection remedies were legal and reasonable. Throughout this process, at one point, county councils threatened to advise their clients not to execute contracts if more changes were not provided by DHS. We proposed legislation in 2003 to cover other certain issues. At one point, DHS substituted a new group of people to be working with, and we met with a representative from the governor's office. We also had groups of commissioners from around the state meet with the governor's office as well. So here we are now, 3.5 years later, and with House Bill 3303. What we propose here is to incorporate a short list of reoccurring contract provisions in contracts with state agencies. They're essentially the same as we have been discussing and identified 3 years ago. They're the ones which cause the counties to reevaluate whether there is too high a price they have to pay in terms of policy choices on legal and risk exposures in order to continue their roles in providing vital services in the communities. Well, some progress has been made in getting some contract changes. Counties feel that they have probably extracted as much value as they can from face-to-face discussion at this point. We, at this point, feel unfortunately obligated to go to the next level, and in terms of trying to improve the compatibility with our relationship with the state, we've come to you. If you adopt House Bill 3303 and amendments, we would have a more clear baseline on the parameters for contract terms in state and county agreements on provisions we can continue to be concerned about. I'll just briefly mention what those provisions are. The first one covers a recurring problem we have with multi-year contracts, and it's covered in Section 1, Subsection 1. This provision would help ensure that for all county-state contracts, the level of service counties agree to provide is commensurate with the funding that is budgeted. The rights are reciprocal in this particular provision. The state budgets every 2 years, while the counties budget every 1 year. So from a county perspective, when we get a multi-year contract with no opportunity to terminate due to non-appropriations decisions in our annual budgeting process, we're precluded then from implementing our budget decisions. This provision would fix that, and it would also provide the same reciprocal right for the state. Next, there are about three provisions I'm going to group together that I feel would help refocus the county-state relationship on the partnership and the reciprocity that should be existing. First is the provision on indemnity. It's covered in Section 1, Subsection 2A. It provides that if one party wants to be protected against liability caused by the other party's actions, both parties would have the same protection against each other's acts. Again, reciprocity. Currently, there are a significant number of state-county agreements in which only the counties are obligated to indemnify the state for their conduct. The state generally refuses to provide indemnity to counties to cover their conduct. I think perhaps it may be DHS's position as well that their current practice is not to require counties to agree to unilaterally indemnify them. Yet the reality is we still get contracts with such unilateral provisions from them. We're simply asking for reciprocity and that each party be responsible for their own actions. Section 1, subsection 2B provides that if the contract unilaterally allows one party to collect amounts that are due from the other party, this right to collect should be reciprocal. Right now, these provisions are drafted as unilateral in favor of the state only. Another provision premised on reciprocity is in Section 1, subsection 2E. It provides that common law rights and defenses applying to contracts should equally be available to both parties. In many state-county agreements, the state states its rights based on common law only in its favor, and the contract may be silent or vague as to any equal common law rights that the counties may have. This provision would eliminate any confusion that common law applies to both parties when the circumstances warrant. Next, there are several provisions we feel we need which would expressly limit contract language to what the law provides or permits. For example, certain law covers the liability a county or state may have for acts or of their employees or agents. Section 1, subsection 2D of this bill would prevent each party from expanding or creating any new liability beyond what the law provides, despite the use of broad, sweeping contract language. Another provision, if adopted, this bill would prohibit a party from recovering funds owed by the other party through a process of offsetting. This means that a party who believes they are owed money in one contract may look to other contracts or the same contract and simply not pay what they owe. The difficulty with allowing this self-help offsetting process is that all of the contracts that we have been included in budgets and budgeted for providing services or programs and not for paying debts. We cannot budget the same money for two different purposes. Under the Oregon Constitution and Attorney General opinions, each party needs the ability to maintain control over their own budget, and this offsetting is not allowed. There are likely other legal avenues and options available for one party to collect amounts that they are due from the other. We've been discussing with DHS arbitration, and we've gotten some success for certain types of disputes. However, they have not been willing to consider arbitration whenever the county claims that the state owes them money, only the reverse. So they have not agreed to a reciprocal one. Our difficulty in that this provision would fix is that we're trying to ensure that our contracts are constitutional and are not void. If we have void contracts, it means that whatever we can decide what we want to perform, they can pay us whatever they want or don't want to pay, and we have no certainty here. We have no enforceable way to ensure that we both perform what we are supposed to with our taxpayer dollars. We also ask that the common law rule providing that ambiguities be construed against the drafting party be incorporated into the statute, and at least one agency, DHS, does not want to recognize that. The reason this provision is critical to counties is that it reflects the huge disparity in the economic power the state wields against the counties, including in contract language and discussions. They often threaten they won't fund us if we don't sign their contracts with difficult provisions in them, or even that we have to repay funds which we appropriately used for services in the past if we don't sign. It is consistent with the role the state continually describes for itself as simply a funding source for the counties to adopt this provision. It also reflects the reality that essentially all the language which counties have developed and drafted and proposed to the state in attempt to resolve issues has been rejected by the state. It would recognize that overly broad and vague language that the state insists on using should be construed against them despite more simple, straightforward language. This would provide counties a fairness and equalization of the playing field when they simply have little bargaining power. Finally, our bill would place some limit on the short deadlines counties are given to review and return contracts or face losing funding. In closing, I wanted to mention that the counties have proposed some additional amendments in light of concerns that the state has raised in a preliminary meeting on this bill, and to address some other concerns of the AAA agencies. Those amendments, I understand, are going to be included in an additional work session or further consideration. I want to thank you for the time that you provided today to hear our support of this bill, and I also urge you to support the bill. We can provide a better government by adopting this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Bieda, do you want to?
For the record, Anthony Bieda. I represent Lane County and from the Oregon Legislature. Just briefly wanted to reiterate that you've heard now from agency folks who have to deliver services that are funded and controlled by this body at the local level, and the complications that they encounter in terms of the egregious language that is being proposed year in and year out, contract in and contract out by our state partners. You've heard from legal counsel in terms of the technical elements of those problems and some suggested remedies. I just wanted to reiterate from a policy standpoint that either implied or expressed over a period of time in statute, this body has memorialized the idea that their partnership with county government and local nonprofits that county government uses to deliver these services is in fact a preferred mode of delivery, and that those benefits include the fact that you get with that locally controlled planning, you get locally controlled accountability and oversight of the delivery of those services and programs, and you get a lower cost delivery structure. A lot of these nonprofits are very basic in terms of their administrative overhead, and they're able to extract a great deal of value from the resources that you all provide, either state or federal money that flows through the state to serve people in the community. And to the degree that contract language or proposed contract language gets in the way of that relationship or imperils that relationship or makes that relationship less than user-friendly, it gives pause to the county governments in particular to reconsider the role they want to play in that partnership. We think that's why, because you all have an investment in that partnership, this issue, which is at the end of the day largely one set of legal opinions versus another set of legal opinions, needs to be in front of this body. And with that, I'd entertain any questions.
Fine. Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the panel or from the committee? We could summarize this. You're trying to standardize basic contractual terms between counties and state agencies that eliminate unfair advantage one way or the other. I'm just trying to summarize in a sort of layperson's fashion what we're talking about here.
Yeah, we're trying to standardize contract provisions, provide reciprocity to both, so we're recognizing that both parties have some rights here, and we're also needing to establish some parameters on how far this language can go, how broadly it can go, so that we don't have to keep arguing, look, you're not using very specific language here, this is going beyond what the law allows or requires, and can't we please change the language to just reflect the law? So those are the purposes.
Let me ask, are you contemplating any further amendments beyond the dash one?
Yes, we have drafted in response to some of the issues we heard raised from Department of Human Services and Department of Justice in the last couple of days, and also from the area agencies on aging relative to does this language include counties, or does it include counties and other agencies that would include the AAAs. We have drafted a set of amendments to the Dash 1 amendments that further refine that.
And when you say you drafted those, have you drafted those through legal, legislative counsel, or they?
We have not put in a note to our legislative counsel yet.
All right. Let me. Those would be then, presumably, the Dash 2 amendments, and that would take in Ted Stevens' situation to bring in LCOG as a part of the definition of county. I had a request from an ODOT representative this morning, and he may be in the audience. Do we have an ODOT person here? Yes, we do. That they had some particular difficulties with the bill in terms of their federal compliance problems and receipt of federal money. Do you have any objection to omitting them from the bill, or should I call a witness up? And
well, as part of our second round of amendments, we have included some language that would address terms of federal dollars and federal grants and statutes and requirements. As far as the provision related to offsetting and a party being able to take future payments, we said that provision would be void. There would be an exception to that to the extent that the federal government or other third-party funding source requires by statute, regulation, or contract the inclusion of a term authorizing recovery of their funds from future payments and contracts with subcontracting agencies. So if the federal government requires that kind of a provision, then it would not be void and
would stand.
Well, there's an ODOT representative here, and I could either take his testimony, or I could say in the formation of the Dash 2 amendments, would you talk with him?
He'd be glad
and
to.
If it poses a real serious problem for their agency, which is unique to them, then I would suggest just omitting them unless... I don't think this is really what you're trying to get at. You're really dealing more with contractors and Department of Human Resources, am I correct?
In terms of the state agencies where we do most of our work, Department of Health and Human Services, Department of Corrections, et cetera.
Do you think your Dash 2 amendments then would limit the bill to the contract relationship with Department of Human Resources, or would it include other state agencies? Forgetting ODOT for a moment.
We've not contemplated omitting by name specific agencies at this point, but rather are interested in seeing if we can't make revisions to the language so that their agency by agency concerns are addressed in the final product.
All right. Well, are there any further questions from the committee? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Please correct my understanding, but for clarification, are we really trying to get to, in the contract language that you're referencing, the unpredictability and or instability and or lack of adequate funding for the services that you're providing at a county level?
That is definitely part of it, and the liabilities that we are asked or required to take on when we do decide to perform services on behalf of the state. It's the extra cost and liability to counties who, I mean, we don't have a whole lot of extra money similar to the state to be able to reasonably and intelligently want to be able to continue if we have to have increasingly greater provisions on liability, and that's the main thing. The other sort of issue here is that our process for being able to raise objections is that we have to contact the specific program staff person, contract by contract, county by county. If it's a legal concern, it's up to the program person to decide whether they want to ask a state attorney to become involved. And several times the expense of having to pay for a state attorney by that agency has been represented as a reason they didn't want to pursue our
request. So we have very little process for being able to really meaningfully negotiate with folks, and particularly if we're talking about a number of state agencies. We've just dealt with DHS, not even started with other state agencies that have we have similar problems with.
Mr. Chair, could I answer that question as well? Representative Flores, in addition to Ms. Laidlaw's comments, I think it's also fair to reflect that the provisions in statute, or the provisions in contract language that we are trying to address with this bill, are provisions that have been propagated, proposed, and debated for nearly 4 years. So before there was a deficiency in funding, if we could use that loose term, either at a state or federal level or certainly local level for the delivery of these programs, this language was being propagated. So to some degree, there is a basis for us having concerns about this language, even when funding was at a more robust level.
Thank you.
Fine, thank you. Representative Berard. Who at the state level did you have the ongoing discussions with?
It would be Department of Human Service representatives. For about the first year and a half, we had there were quite a few of them, 10 to 12 folks that seemed to be in mid-management level. We had also some county program staff people as well as county councils there. Then the process switched gears, and I think for the next year and a half got a different group of DHS folks, and Gary Weeks became involved as the director for the department, and we got, I think, probably a higher level of administrator that we were dealing with, another group of folks. And then Mr. Saki, Clyde Saki, has been involved. So we've had various levels of that. The first year and a half as well, we were dealing with attorneys from the AG's office. We had one that continued through the process, and we probably had six or seven that kind of rotated in and out of the process. It was a bit difficult to establish any kind of ongoing communication or work relationship with those attorneys.
Comment, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Sounds like they've had the same problem the legislature has. Except maybe we can cure their problem. We can't cure ours.
Correct.
Okay. Further questions from the committee? Thank you for your testimony. The way I want to leave this is if you want to walk up to my office now, I'll give you the note on the Dash 2 amendments, and I want you to make contact with the ODOT representative that's here this morning so that you make sure we include them in that last workout to the Dash 2 amendments. And with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3303. Further business before the committee? Hearing none, we are adjourned.
Interesting that none of the state agencies...